This podcast is brought to you by Lanco Group, your business partner for engineering solutions. You are listening to FNR Football Nation Radio.
You're listening to Evenings on FNR Football Nation Radio.
Hello, I'm your host, Louise Taffer, with Nick Dibano joining me here in the studio. A big day, lots of news to get through. Please get involved at any time by giving us a call on 03 99 44 99 99, or you can tweet to us at FNR_radio, or you can comment below if you are joining us on our Facebook Live. Nick, you're very happy today.
Always am, Louise.
But you're even more happier today.
What would that be?
Because your favourite restaurant below us have finally reopened.
Well, yeah, they opened up on Monday, and I was quite vocal about it on Twitter, especially saying that it was quite an atrocity. They've been closed for the longer period than what they advertised, but they were back. I was able to get myself a nice feed before the show, but also it's been a big day full of football news, Louise. The A-League expansion team announcing their new colours, their name, and also their new head coach with Ante Milicic taking over at MacArthur FC, who wear black and gold this year. And have the bull mainly as their main logo, potentially their mascot heading into the when they come into the A-League in 2020.
Now, we saw a lot of people not really like and enjoy Western United's new logo. What do you make of MacArthur FC's new logo?
Are you a fan? I'm a big fan. I reckon it's simple, straight to the point. I love the colours, black and gold. It's something a bit different. It's very similar to Western Sydney's away jersey this season. They had that nice black and gold strip that they
got.
That
was really classy,
wasn't it? I really like that. So if they've got something similar to that, it might ruffle up a few feathers with the Wanderers fans, who are going to be their new rivals once they come into in terms of geography. So be interesting to see what happens once they're in the A-League by the time 2020 ticks around.
And I also see that the three stars of the Southern Cross on the logo actually symbolise football's links with the grassroots football, the National Premier League, and also the A-League.
Yeah, well, who knows? I guess that's the way it is. Obviously, they had that big, sort of event today where they were able to unveil it, and they've made that announcement. Ante Milicic, though, named as the coach.
Yes.
2020 taking over as soon as his time as the Matildas head coach ends at the end of the Tokyo Olympics. So it's good to see that he's been announced. He was almost a red-hot favourite. And I think it's...
And a lot of that speculation almost was put to bed when we heard that he was given a contract extension with the Matildas. But then now we've seen that that is only until the end of the Olympics campaign. And perfect timing, though, for him to take up post at MacArthur FC.
Well, also during that time, because obviously being the coach of a national team, there obviously he has a bit more probably time on his hands as well to help obviously juggle Matildas and also juggle MacArthur FC duties, obviously when it comes to signing players and also when it comes to putting the team on the park, because by the time the Olympics have ticked over, he'll have some sort of ideal of what sort of team he'll have and also what sort of system he'd want to play. And I think it'll be a very similar system to what we see with the Matildas. And obviously, he'll be looking to recruit players of those sort of attributes that are able to play his very attacking game style. So I'm excited to see what happens. It'll be the 12th A-League team. And hopefully, by the time 2020 tick around, it will correlate with the new A-League, which will help captivate audiences. Something that, you know, this year has dropped off a little bit. There's been a lot of controversy about that. But obviously, that's a story for another day. So, look, it's, as you said, big news today also coming out of the other expansion team. Western United announced now another signing, Brendan Hamill, the former Western Sydney Wanderers captain, joins the team. Another centre-back joining their ranks, who will probably more than likely be in probably starting contention for that first game. Adds some experience down there.
Yeah, so Western United is coming along quite nicely at the moment. Just want to announce the coach, though. I want to hear who the coach is.
They might have a full squad before they even announce their coach.
I think that is probably a really good possibility.
Well,
that, that'll be the case.
Now they actually have. They have Aaron Calver, Jonathan Aspro, Connor Chapman, Brendan Hamill, and Ersin Ghulam that can all play in centre-back. I assume Connor Chapman probably play a bit further up the field. So they've got about five centre-back options, so I don't think they're going to be dipping into the centre-back market anymore. They're quite sold with their defensive options as well, having also Parais and Risden as their two full-back options. So they've basically got the defence sorted. They've got their two goalkeepers.
They'll just need one more goalkeeper.
Well, I don't think they'll get three. I think that third goalkeeper will probably come through a youth academy sort of thing that they might set up. They might look to sign someone else eventually. But I think the next position that they would look to potentially strengthen is in the middle of the park. So they've only got Josh Cavallo, Panayoti Kone, and Sebastian Pasquale. So I think that definitely in the midfield they'll be looking to bolster that stocks. They've got two strikers and a winger on each side. So I think that the attacking positions will start to see them fill up as the weeks go on. There are a lot of free agents at the moment coming through with players being released and also maybe potentially looking overseas. They've got now two players filled as their visa spots, with Curto obviously signing. Ersin Gulam is technically a Turkish international, but was born in Australia. So obviously he doesn't fit under that quota of being one of the five foreign players, which will allow for them to go and sign three players potentially in the off-season who would come in from international base. And with Lou Sticker's connection, you never know who it might be. But we know that that marquee spot's filled. So maybe the big fish would be left to sort of one of the other A-League clubs.
Who would you like to see Western United sign?
It's a very tough question. Depends if we're talking internationals or if we're talking more locally. But if you're going to be looking at someone from probably a local spectrum, I'd like to see them potentially go target someone that's playing either a Socceroo that might need to come back or someone who's fallen out of contention. I think Robbie Cruz would be a good shout. I think that he's obviously now out of contract in Bundesliga too. I wouldn't be surprised to see him playing in the A-League next year. I think that he's gotten to that age now where it's time for him to come back to the A-League. No disrespect to him whatsoever. He's been a fantastic servant for the national team. He's been heavily criticised, but when you've played over 60, 70 games, and also what he's done overseas has been quite spectacular, but he's considering the injuries he's had. So he would probably be a nice signing, I think. But I think as well, I think they should target some of also those young players in the A-League that potentially is looking for a new home. Joe Coletti's one in particular, who I think that would be a nice signing with a long-term view.
I don't think they will get Joe Coletti, because I think Coletti will go overseas to Asia.
Well, we've heard that's actually a big shout, but I think if Western United want to look at someone and maybe try play a last-ditch effort to go get a young player, I wouldn't be surprised if Joe Coletti is definitely on their target list.
And there's a little bit more movement also around the rest of the league. We've heard that Adelaide United have gotten rid of a few of their players today.
Yeah, well, no real surprise about Jordy Thomason, who wasn't able to hit the score sheet in his little stint over at Adelaide. But Scott Galloway, he's left, but he's now signed a three-year contract at Melbourne City. That's now five different A-League clubs. But hopefully now we see some stability, because he's been on the move almost every season. He probably had his best season to date in the A-League this year. I was surprised that Adelaide were to release him. Maybe it was more of a mutual thing if Melbourne City were prepared to offer that. In Melbourne City, they've acted swiftly to get a new right-back in, considering Richie Delatt, we believe, is heading back overseas, back to Aston Villa, who are back in the hunt for Premier League as well. And we'll talk about that one a little bit later. But also, Baba Diawara, their marquee's gone. Me and Josh Parrish have this thing about Baba Diawara. He was almost a good luck charm for Adelaide in the last few games. I was able to get him so close to a grand final. Obviously, missed the penalty in that penalty shootout, but no real surprise there, considering he didn't really have the return that Adelaide would have been hoping for.
And we're almost heading into uncharted waters with Adelaide United, because we don't know who the new head coach is going to be. We don't know what kind of players he's going to sign. So a little bit of uncertainty around the Reds this coming season.
And only, I believe, one signed striker at this point in time in George Blackwood. So with Apostolos Stavratilopoulos and Baba Diawara moving on, and also they've got to start looking to maybe get some fullbacks in. Ryan Strain and I believe Michael Moroney are the only two off the top of my head fullbacks that are re-signed for next season. So defence and up top, I think, are two positions they'll look to strengthen, considering as well in the finals they're playing a bit of a makeshift back four for the majority of the second half of the season, with Moroney and Kito filling in positions that they're not necessarily comfortable in. So it'll be interesting to see what Adelaide do in the off-season, but first they've got to get themselves a coach. So they'll be acting swiftly to do just that.
And moving on, Nick, I hear that 35,000 tickets have already been sold in just a few hours for the A-League Grand Final.
Yeah, I believe that number has actually increased over the past few hours or so. I believe that I saw something on Twitter that there's about 5,000 seats left now at Optus Stadium. So there are about 55,000, which is going to mean a raucous atmosphere on Sunday. And Optus Stadium, they know how to keep the noise in. It's a spectacular ground. It's new. It's big. It's very big. And they've got a fantastic light show and LED spectacular. It'd be good, great for the entertainment part of it as well.
But it also means that if they're already at 55,000, they're just 436 tickets away from beating the previous A-League Grand Final record that was set in 2007 when Melbourne Victory beat Adelaide United here in Docklands.
Fantastic, because I don't think we've ever seen a Grand Final at a bigger capacity than Adelaide Oval or Marvel Stadium. So I think it'd be good to see that now Optus Stadium has a chance to break that. Doesn't mean that all games should be at Optus Stadium. For these sort of games, though, it's fantastic. NIB was an absolute madhouse on Friday night. It was packed to the rafters. And I'm sure that once again on Sunday, they're going to have that exact same atmosphere because everyone loves a grand final, and I'm sure it's going to be a great spectacle.
And it's fitting too, because Perth Glory have had to wait 16 years to host an A-League grand final, and now all the fans are gearing up for it and the locals are just buzzing.
And 7 years, it's been between their last grand final they lost against the Brisbane Roar at Suncorp Stadium in heartbreaking circumstances. But we'll talk to Jonathan Howcroft a bit more about that in just a moment when we get him on the line for the Journos program. And I also believe we're going to have a very special guest joining us at around 5:45. We're joined by Andy Naylor from Brighton, who will be telling us a little bit about what's going on over with Brighton and Hove Albion. They survived with a couple of days to go. Their manager, Chris Hughton, who's a very popular figure down in the south of England, was sacked. And there's a bit of uncertainty there at the moment, so he'll give us a bit of an update what's going on as well with Matt Ryan's boys over there.
Yes, I am looking forward to that because Matty Ryan took to Twitter and was quite upset to see his manager go.
Well, he got them promoted 2 seasons ago. Now they survived once again this year when probably a lot of people might have said they'd be right in that relegation scrap fight, which they were. But they didn't win a game for 8 games, which didn't bode very well. But now I think they were forefront of the football world for a week when it was in Brighton's hands to win the title for Liverpool. So I think that this is going to be
But that wasn't going
to happen. Oh, well, look, there was 40 seconds when Brighton and Hove Albion were in the lead. So obviously you've got to put that into perspective. Anything could happen in football. But
it can.
At the end of the day, I think it was very harsh that they did sack Chris Hughton in the end. I thought that he's done a fantastic job, as we said. Popular figure among the change rooms and also in the EPL world and the football world. He's a well-liked guy, Chris Hughton, and it's unfortunate to see how it's ended like that.
But especially given that Brighton were able to stay up, they weren't relegated.
Yeah, but I do think as well, on top of that, it won't be the last time we see Chris Hughton in the Prem. I think that definitely he'll be one of the first guys that will probably be targeted in the off-season, maybe for a championship team or a team that recently have been relegated. They'll be looking to come straight back up.
You're listening to Evenings on FNR with Louise Taffer and Nick DiBardo joining me here in the studio. And it's time to cross now to our journo. The Guardian's Jonathan Howcroft joins us. Jonathan, thank you so much for coming on the show.
My pleasure. Good evening to you both.
Jonathan, Nick and I have just been chatting a little bit about the new and 12th or 13th?
12th.
A-League team, MacArthur FC, and their new coach. What do you make of the big announcement today?
I think it's fantastic. I'm really impressed with everything that they've done so far. It all seems to have a cohesive feel to it. The messages have been leaking out pretty consistently for quite a long time. And I can't really find... I mean, there were a few glitches in the actual presentation, weren't there, which sometimes you can't avoid. But nothing but positive vibes, really, at the moment.
And Ante Bilicic taking over straight after the Olympics next year in Tokyo. What are your thoughts on this appointment? Almost one of the names that has been touted for quite some time.
Perfect. Suits the club. It gives them a long lead-in, plenty of time for him to establish what kind of squad he wants, those key club-defining players. He's got plenty of time to tap up. He can oversee the development of all of the infrastructure over a long period of time. Clearly, he's going to be busy with his international commitments, but we know that there's plenty of downtime during those spells away from competition as well. So, one of my criticisms of this expansion process and a culture, from a cultural point of view, as much as anything, that we were so desperate to have new teams in, we've thrown Western Melbourne in my opinion, too soon. Now, that's not to put any slight on Steve Horvath and the people putting that club together, because the playing list that they're growing, and it grew again today with Brendan Hamill, looks a really, really smart team that they're comprising. But we know that the cornerstone of their bid was their own ground, and they're not going to have their own ground for a period of time. So why, I kind of wish that our desperation to get them in was tempered a little bit, and we were able to do it to the maximum, maximum optimization. And I feel like we're a lot closer to that with the MacArthur bid, and I thought today was a good demonstration of what that looks like.
And while we're here talking about Ante Milicic, the Matildas squad was also released yesterday. Your thoughts on the team that he will take to France?
Yeah, I think it's powerful. And what I like about it, as much as anything, is it's a creative squad. It's not 1 to 11 with backup 12 to 22. he's given himself options. So I think with the form that they've shown since he took over from Ante Stajic, and how you've got to expect that his game plan will mature with that group over, you know, over the coming weeks leading into the tournament, I think we have every right to be extremely optimistic of their chances. And it's reassuring that we are in this situation after the drama that we saw a few months ago, and credit to Ante Milicic for what he's accomplished in such a short period of time.
And one of the Matildas youngsters, Alex Chidiak, was left out of the squad, and also one of the more household names as well, in Kai Simon. What are your thoughts on this?
I think there's plenty of time still for the final squad to be finessed. And we've seen in all sorts of different tournaments over, you know, in men's and women's football, that there remains opportunities for players to prove their worth. And you're going to get injuries. You're going to get loss of form. You're going to get, you know, but you can't prepare for every eventuality. So I wouldn't rule anybody out definitively at this stage.
And I was particularly delighted to see that 16-year-old Mary Fowler was also included in the squad, because what an opportunity that she's been presented with.
Yeah, it's just a great story. The kind of story that football in Australia really needs to be able to get hold of and sell as a narrative to the broader sporting public, and why international football, international sport in particular, and you know, it's partly why football has this advantage on some of the sporting codes in Australia, is it gives the opportunity to shine a light on players like Mary and stories like hers. So hopefully we'll tell it from many different voices, and it'll be told well over the next few weeks, so that by the end of the World Cup, she's a household name.
And it seems that Australia is certainly continuing that trend, because at the FIFA World Cup in Russia, Australia did have the youngest player there in the tournament, which was Daniel Arzani. And now it seems we will have, again, possibly the youngest player at the FIFA Women's World Cup.
Yeah, and they're on merit as well. You know, it's not a token gesture. It's an earned call-up. So, and we saw the momentum that somebody like Daniel Arzani can generate. Unfortunately for him, his injury shortly after joining Celtic curtailed a lot of that hype. But if we can have a similar impact at the Women's World Cup, that would be superb.
And Jonathan, let's have a look ahead to this weekend, the A-League Grand Final, Perth v Sydney. Does Sydney go into the favourites after their big win against the Melbourne Victory on Sunday?
Oh, it's tempting. It's tempting to say that, isn't it? But I don't think you can deny Perth favouritism after they finished top of the ladder. It's a home Grand Final. They haven't fluked it this season. I mean, they went down to the last kick of the night against Adelaide, but they've been so powerful for the whole season, and with Tony Popovic as coach. But in the last two or three weeks, it's absolutely tightened up. If you'd have asked me at any point from about round three onwards, I would have said, well, it's Perth to lose. I think it's tighter than that now. I think Sydney legitimately can win it. I don't think Perth have to lose it. And there's just so many variables that are hard to legislate for. I mean, principally among them, the venue. We know that there'll be a massive home support for Perth, but as a facility, it will be pretty new to them and may well prove to be a leveller. So I still think Perth deserve favouritism, but I reckon it's as tight as it's been all season.
And it seems that tickets are nearly sold out.
It's extraordinary, and I take my hat off to Perth spectators. When this decision was being discussed a couple of weeks ago, my gut reaction is to let clubs keep it at their home venues, because I think that there is something special about football played at those tight rectangular grounds with parochial home support. I don't care too much for that extra 10 or 15,000. When you're talking about, say, in Melbourne, the difference between Amy Park and Etihad, it doesn't to me, or Marvel Stadium now, sorry, it doesn't feel like that much of a win. And clearly, there's a financial incentive to do it. But once that number, you know, once that number came through today and it's over 50,000, it does. I do have to take a step back and say, okay, fair enough. When you're talking about doubling the potential attendance, or maybe even more than doubling the potential attendance, that is quite a significant step change. But I still think, as a football culture, we should be more comfortable with accepting the smaller attendance for how football specific an atmosphere that generates, and how we should celebrate that football specific atmosphere, and then ultimately get to a point where these clubs are playing in venues that are big enough on a week by week basis to accommodate a grand final like that at what they would call their home ground anyway. But I'm happy to be wrong on this occasion, and I look forward to seeing what that venue looks like full of football fans.
And Jonathan, are you heading over to Perth to watch the game?
I'm not. No, I'm doing this one on the telly. Busy night ahead for that one, with a few different things on the go. So it'll be a late night.
Well, it's a massive game, and talking a little bit about crowds and everything else. So, like, is it really surprising that you think that they've almost got to capacity, considering most grand finals, even when it was at Adelaide Oval and at Marvel Stadium in the past, they've gotten close to that 55,000 range?
Do you know, I'm so out of my depth trying to predict and understand this kind of thing. I just don't feel qualified to speak on behalf of that section of the Australian population that is happy to go to one game. I just can't put my head in, you know, I can't empathise properly. Yeah, I grew up as a match goer. I went, you know, to every home game for my team for many, many years, as many away games as I would go to, win or lose. So for me, that I can associate with the average 8,000 to 10,000 Perth fans that have been going for you know, most of their time in the A-League. I have no idea genuinely where that next 40,000 come from, and why they go, and what's in it for them. Why this game and not so many of the others? Is it that 8,000 to 10,000 isn't made up of 8,000 to 10,000 individuals? It's made up of this 40,000 or 50,000 distributed over a whole season, or what? I don't know. But it was as if, you know, listening to people from WA when it seemed clear that Perth were going to host a grand final, there was no doubt in anybody's mind that they were going to get 35,000, 40,000 easy. So there is clearly that spectator base there. But as for who it comprises, I just don't know. You know, is it people who will go to one day of Test cricket, one Wallabies test, one, I don't know, you know, I genuinely don't know. And that number completely staggers me, and I'm delighted that it exists. But it's a heck of a job for Tony Pignatta and his team to try and use this experience to get more through the gate on a week-by-week basis, because the team's good enough, clearly the population exists, the home ground on a week-by-week basis is good. And it's, you know, it's a great challenge of the A-League, isn't it? Converting all of this potential support into regular attendees.
I think it's quite interesting, because it probably is also those fans that probably are just coming along for the spectacle of a grand final, because we do know that there are those ones, even for all the other codes when it comes to the AFL and NRL, that probably just do come along because they want to see a big crowd and a big sporting event. So maybe it's those sort of people as well.
Yeah, and I that would be my presumption as well. And what I feel like you've elucidated there really, really smartly is that we should be doing this week in, week out. Every week should have that grand final spectacle feel to it, because what makes football unique is what the crowd brings. And you know, you think of like Anzac Day in the AFL. Collingwood and Essendon half the time aren't the best teams in the competition, but they still fill the MCG because the spectacle draws. You know, nothing attracts a crowd like a crowd. So we need to get better at selling the crowd experience, because it is unique and it is brilliant, and it is alone irrespective of what's happening on the pitch, a lot of the times worth getting those kind of theatre goers in and then converting those theatre goers into participants rather than spectators. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, that conversion into participants, I think, is something that we've really failed at in this country for a number of years. Mm-hmm. And, you know, without second guessing another question or segueing us into another topic, you know, the story this week of what's happened to Rory Carroll at Jubilee Stadium is, you know, it's another example of that, isn't it? That we failed to look after our own interests when it comes to supporters.
Yeah, exactly. And it does sort of segue perfectly into Sunday's discussion, Jonathan, but it's more from an on-the-field perspective. Melbourne Victory were shambolic, to say the least, in that 6-1 defeat. Where does this leave Kevin Muscat, do you believe?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I've been really interested to see the debate this week about it, and particularly the perspective of people saying that it's the right time for a change. I have not felt that at all this season, and I still don't feel it now. I can see it. I can see that perspective. I think there is merit to it, but I don't feel it. For as long as Kevin Muscat has been coach, for maybe the first half of his time as coach, I felt, well, okay, he's carrying on what Ange Postecoglou did. He's got Paul Trimboli as football operations. He's not breaking something that's fixed. And then I felt over the last year, 18 months or so, it's become his team, and he's taken control of a lot of those behind the scenes aspects, and the team is playing in his image. And how they got the championship last season. I mean, it's one of the great stolen championships, and I mean that politely, you know, as an endorsement of what they did in that final series. And then this season, he comes in with a diamond midfield. He's got Keisuke Honda and Ola Toivonen, who are players with bigger reputations than he has as a coach. He's still got to try and balance high-profile names like Costa Barbarousis and James Troisi. And for up until, what was it, maybe round 9 or 10, for 3 or 4 weeks in a row, they were playing football of a standard that is as good as anything we've seen in the competition. The ceiling that Victory team had was probably higher than any other team in the competition this season. Then Honda gets injured. The difficulty of balancing the Asian Champions League comes in. They lose a couple of games. Troisi gets injured. A couple of players lose form. I think he made a mistake in his handling of the defence, the goalkeeper situation in particular. But also, as unfashionable as they may have looked, and they may not be in everybody's best 11, but I thought Storm Rue and Corey Brown a solid job doers, and I think by the end he was shoehorning in the 4 players that he thought he wanted in the team as personalities necessarily more than the roles that they were there to perform, and I think that backfired, and a lot of things went wrong against Sydney FC. So I wouldn't read too much into that one result. Everything went wrong on the night. Fine, they lost, and it was humiliating, but it was an away final to a very good team, and nights like that happen. To reverse engineer a narrative of everything's gone wrong as a consequence of that just doesn't sit right. I think they took a couple of gambles this season, and ultimately they didn't pay off. But I don't feel like they were risks that weren't worth taking. And if Honda had have stayed fit, if they had have retained a bit more form towards the back end of the season, I think this could have been a very different conversation. Another point that definitely does, you know, worth raising and mentioned it in passing is historically the Asian Champions League is an enormous impediment to doing well in the A League, and it, again, it's proven with Melbourne Victory. Now Sydney FC are through to the grand final, and they may disprove, you know, be one of the exceptions in that narrative. But over the duration of the A-League, it's incredibly tough to play in both competitions. And I think that has to be factored into how Melbourne Victory have finished this season.
Well, Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us on Evenings on FNR. And we look forward to chatting to you again at the same time next week to recap all of the A-League Grand Final action.
Yeah, it should be a good one. Really, really, really looking forward to it.
All right. Thanks, Jonathan. Take care. We'll speak to you soon.
Thank you very much.
That was The Guardian's Jonathan Howcroft joining us there. And while we are just touching on Melbourne Victory, the PFA have actually released their A-League team of the season for 2018-19. And the Victory only, as expected, got one player in the team. That was Ola Toivonen.
No real shock. I would have thought maybe Costa Barbarouzas could have been another shout. Keisuke Honda was in and out of the team a bit too much. Terry Antonis was... he was good in bits. Like, he started the season like a house on fire, then sort of tailed off a bit towards the end when he got that injury. Yeah, I think that Ola Toivonen's probably been one of the great marquees, and what would you say, marquee, one of the great international imports that they've managed to bring in, and he's still at the peak of his powers and doing that. So I think if he stayed fit for the whole year, he probably would have won the Golden Boot. Unfortunately, he didn't for his sake. But at the end of the day, great season, big tick. Hopefully he's still there again next season.
And also no surprises that the team has four Perth Glory stars.
Run us through the team, Louise.
The team of the season that the PFA have put out is led by captain Diego Castro. And as I was touching on, the squad also features other teammates such as Jason Davidson, Neil Kilkenny, Chris Economides and Liam Reddy. While the coach is Tony Popovich, we have Philip Curto in goal, Ryan Grant, but Schenkerfeld has also made the team. Brandon O'Neill is in the heart of the midfield, and we also have Roy Krishna there. So a decent starting 11. I probably wouldn't really change anything.
No, I think that's just about right. I think that's probably the best 11 to go with. I reckon that's quite a solid one.
And on the bench, we have Liam Reddy, Jakobsen, Isaias, Ninkovic, and Adam Lafondra.
Sounds just about right. Well, look, Louise, we're starting to get closer towards the grand final. We're only 4 days away. It's been an exciting season. Just want to pose a question to you off the cuff.
Go.
A little bit different. What's been your favourite moment of the season this year?
What's been my favourite moment?
If you had to pick one moment which has stood out for you.
One moment. Does it have to be a game or
just
generally?
It can be anything. Just mainly about the A-League season in general.
I have really liked how Perth Glory have played.
Yeah? But is there any specific moment about Perth Glory in particular which stood out for you?
Oh, it had to be round one, round two, when they were ready to go.
You think when they beat maybe the Victory in round two? Because I know in round one, I think they had that early draw, and then round two, they really stood out against the Victory, yeah.
They did. And the fact that they had that back three going, and as I said, it was ready to go from the start, was really telling that they had done their homework.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. I think if I was to particularly choose one, I think it'd be Wellington Phoenix's rise. I think just in particular, some of those games that they played were absolutely brilliant, especially here in Melbourne. I think the one game, that 3-0 draw at Amy Park in January, was absolutely fantastic, just end-to-end, and from both teams, it was a great spectacle. But I think if we're going to talk about entertainment value, I think the best moment would have had to have come from Friday night. I think that was one of the crazy football games I've ever watched.
Insane.
I genuinely thought it was going to be a snooze fest. Like, I was very critical. I thought this is going to be a game that I probably will be going to sleep early. But the end, I saw just Baba Diawara made it 2-1. Then seconds to go, Ryan Kiddo slammed that goal. Just end-to-end, incredible penalty shootout. Great game for the entertainment spectacle.
Liam Reddy, what was going? He was just on fire.
And Paul Izzo as well was absolutely brilliant between the sticks. Can't take anything from him away as well. If there's been one moment which has sort of shocked you a little bit in terms of maybe something that's happened a bit more peculiar, something a little bit more weird, has there been one moment stood out for you?
I would just say, well, not really shocked me, but just how bad the Mariners were this season.
Well, I'm going to top you with that. I'm going to say when they played on New Year's Eve and the goalpost broke, I think that was probably the best moment. Well, one of the more funny moments where you just turn around and go, what's going
on? But that's an A-League moment.
That's what we call peak A-League. Yep. So that is literally peak A-League. There's been plenty of those. It seems like it happens all the time when it comes to the A-League, more last season, this season in particular. But it's been another great season. Hopefully it all ends in the right way, get a fantastic grand finals. A bit disappointed on Sunday, not just with the game, but obviously with everything else that went on around it. It just really soured the result for Sydney FC and not having that big blue to sort of end the year where both teams could put on an absolute show. And it just wasn't that exciting. And I think that was a bit of a dampener to what's been a fantastic season.
I don't think Alex Bross would agree with you.
No, not at all. I think that Alex Prost and Lafondre would have absolutely loved that performance. They were great. I believe that Adam Lafondre is joining you tomorrow as well.
He is. Tune in at 5 o'clock because Sydney FC's main goal poacher will be on the show with George and myself.
Yeah, well, it'll be good to hear from him. It's getting closer towards that day. And Adam Lafondre, a guy who's had a brilliant first season in the A-League. Hopefully sticks around next year and keeps on going. He's got a nice little partnership up there with Alex Brox. Unfortunately, Brox will be moving on at the end of the season. But about Sydney FC, another thing which I find quite interesting, that next year we forget that they're actually going to get a big player making a return. And he's sort of been a forgotten player. Trent Bahadur. I was actually doing a bit of reading saying that, you know, he's done his ACL, obviously, at the start of the year. And he had a brilliant FFA Cup campaign before he went down. He's a guy that showed a lot at the Mariners in little bits. He showed he had the potential but never was able to really kick on, and it looked like at Sydney FC this year he was going to have a big season.
Yeah, I know. And now that we haven't really seen him at all at Sydney FC, it's great that they will be able to access him next season because he is someone who can certainly make a difference.
Well, if him and Luke Jovanovic are probably two of the great hopes at Sydney FC to come through and potentially play a big role in the future and help keep him up at the top, and because obviously it depends what's going to happen with Ninkovic getting a bit older now.
And what happens with Danny De Silva? He'll be recalled back
to
the
Mariners. Maybe the Sydney FC might look to try and come up with some sort of agreement, might either get him back on loan, Mariners might release him, allow for Sydney to get take him back. So whether Sydney want him back, because Reza Guccianashad and also CM Deong are players as well that may not be there next season. So there might be another bit of a clean out in their attacking stocks. Maybe Lafondre might be one of the last ones standing with Trent Bahadur.
I think they definitely need to keep Adam Lafondre.
Oh, 100%.
Reza, I wasn't too fond of season.
I think he can redeem himself with a big performance off the bench potentially in the grand final. He might have a big moment to play still.
Reza the hero.
Yeah, well, look, I don't think he'll be there next season. And his actual Iranian teammate, Ali Reza Jahangbakhsh, I know that he's obviously he's known very well by our next guest. He'll be joining us in about 5 minutes, Andy Naylor. So talking a little bit about Premier League now, Louise, we're getting towards the nitty-gritty. Obviously, it's all over. We're getting towards the nitty-gritty of the championship, Aston Villa this morning, they kicked on. They're staying around. They're looking, getting closer towards potentially a return back to the Premier League. Last year, they lost the playoff final to Fulham. Milo Yednak came on, clutch moment in the penalty shootout, as he's done so many times throughout his career and scored a massive penalty. And Aston Villa have timed their run perfectly, are now in a playoff final, and they will potentially be taking on Leeds United or Derby County, who play tomorrow. And Leeds have been front and centre of controversy for this whole season under Marcelo Bielsa. And they had a big game against Villa not long ago. Potentially a rematch is on the cards.
Oh, can you imagine if that is the case?
I want to see it.
It would just go off.
I want to see this.
There'll be fireworks, probably red cards.
There will be definitely red cards. I genuinely think this game's going to have a lot of spite to it. This is actually the richest game in football. I believe it's like a $95 million prize pool if you get promoted, which goes a long way when you're going to be playing in the Prem, and it will help, obviously, in terms of trying to get your squad ready for next season, but bringing in some new players. It will be interesting to see if Aston Villa can do it, because they are the team that are in form at the moment, while Leeds at the moment, whether they get there, aren't necessarily in the same form. They won their first game in quite some time in that first leg. And Derby, who are head coached by Frank Lampard, who could potentially be on his way to Brighton next year as the new manager, I believe, he's going to have a bit of a task on the road to try and rescue that one goal disadvantage.
Who do you think might be promoted? Can Villa get through?
I think it's going to be
Mile Jedinak will stay around for the ride.
I think it's going to be more heartbreak for Leeds. I think Villa are going up. I just think they've timed their run brilliantly. I think it's just Leeds this at the moment have fallen apart. They look tired.
Aston Villa at the moment. It is such a long season in the championship.
It's a 46-game campaign. And I spoke a lot to Josh Parrish about this on the Lightning Round a couple of weeks ago. And we said that Leeds, they play such an attacking brand that they've almost gassed themselves out now. And it's got to that point of the year where they didn't just pace themselves, and they got to a point in time now where they're tired. And Aston Villa have just perfectly timed this run. And right now they're in a position where it looks like they're going to be going back to the Premier League. They got relegated, I believe, back in 2016 or 2015. They had a really poor season in the Prem that year. They've taken a couple of years to come back. It's three seasons down the championship. They're historically, just like Leeds, a very successful club. And they'll be looking to get back up into the Prem where they believe they belong, because they lost that playoff final 1-0 to Fulham last year, and will be looking to join Norwich and Sheffield United in the Premier League next season. And I think they've definitely got the squad to do it, and hopefully Mile Jedinak gets his Premier League swan song.
Hopefully he does.
Well, think about
it. Is his contract out at the end of the season, though?
I think it may be, but I'd like to see him potentially get one more year. I'm going to fact check that one. But also because there's the rumours of him going to Southwest Sydney, and I think it would tie perfectly into finishing up.
So maybe one more year with Villa and then come back to the A-League.
And he's had a lot of injuries at Aston Villa over the past season, so I think that for him just to get a chance to play in the Premier game would be great. He had a great little tenure at Crystal Palace as their main man in the middle of the park. He scored some big goals. I remember he scored one in particular against Liverpool, this amazing free kick that he scored back in, I believe, about 2015 or 2016. I believe our producer Nick Hughes know about that. Give me the thumbs up. Yep, definitely it was that moment. Doesn't really want to remember it fondly for those Liverpool fans out there. But, you know, it'll be good to see him back in the Prem. I think he's been a fantastic servant throughout English football since he's made that move after 10 years in Australia, obviously in the A-League and also in Turkey.
Well, Nick, we're going to take a quick break because coming up is our guest from Brighton.
You're listening to Evenings on FNR, Football Nation Radio.
You're listening to Evenings on FNR, Louise Taffer with Nick D'Urbano joining me here in the studio. And it's time to cross to our guest, Brighton and Hove Albion reporter, Andy Naylor. Andy, good morning and thank you for coming on the show.
Good morning to you.
Andy, what was your reaction to Chris Hughton's departure and how was his sacking received there in the UK?
My reaction on Monday morning when I heard the news was shock, to be honest with you. It did come a little bit out of the blue. You know, the season had only just finished the day before. It felt as if the kind of crisis moment for him when they'd lost at home to Cardiff the previous month had passed. They'd managed to scramble their way to safety. And it felt like, you know, he would be given a chance to carry on. So certainly the timing of it came as a bit of a surprise. In terms of the way it's been greeted, a lot of different opinions on both sides of the debate, really. Strong opinions on one hand, people who think it was the right call by the owner chairman Tony Bloom, and it is his decision, very much his decision. This is the man who's pumped £300 million into the club. It's his call. And people on the other side saying, no, you know, be careful what you wish for, and that Chris Hughton, who for four of his 4.5 years at the club has been very successful, has been badly treated.
And it seems like it was not unwarranted, but the fact that he had led the Seagulls to surviving relegation, that he would stick around for another season?
Yeah. I think the rationale, Tony Bloom's logic behind this decision, is that if Brighton continued in the same vein at the start of next season, as they have been in the second half of this season, then you could reach a stage by October, November when a decision might have to be made then. You've already had the summer transfer window lost and it's more difficult to get in your ideal manager as a replacement. So that's the kind of rationale. I understand that rationale. I just feel a little bit uncomfortable about the haste with which Chris Hughton has been dispensed with. Mm. Bearing in mind, you know, this is a club that has only spent 6 years of its history, entire history, in the top flight of English football. And he's kind of done what it said on the tin since he came in. He kept them out of falling into the third tier, League One, got them promoted. And whichever way you look at the way the season has panned out, they have survived. They have stayed up, you know, two seasons. And that an awful lot of clubs and an awful lot of bigger clubs have gone down.
Andy, it's Nick here. And look, just looking at Brighton season from obviously face value, it hasn't been that bad as well with that deep FA Cup run as well, which coincided with this season, obviously getting to a semi-final. Do you think that's strange considering as well Brighton looking to get that bit of silverware potentially on the side came that close?
Yeah, I suppose there is an argument that that kind of papered over the cracks At the end of the day, they got to an FA Cup semi-final and, you know, ran Man City pretty close at Wembley as well. But they kind of got there primarily once they'd beaten Bournemouth by beating Championship teams and beating them narrowly. I mean, they should have lost at Millwall in the quarter-final, there's no doubt about that. But I think that kind of emphasised the squad that Chris Hughton had at his disposal. In terms of where Brighton should be. They had a great first season in the Premier League. Euphoria, everyone said, fantastic, staying up, 15th, 40 points. My mind goes back to August when I look at the clubs and think to myself, right, who are Brighton going to finish above? I looked at Huddersfield and I looked at Cardiff, the two that stood out. After that, I would have put them in a group of five, six clubs who, depending on the fine margins, it could go either way. They might finish 18th and go down. They might finish 14th, 15th. I put Brighton in that group. You know, Fulham was a bit of a... We didn't really know what to expect from Fulham. They spent 100 million quid and went down a while ago. So, they were a bit of an unknown quantity. So... Although the second half of the season, there's no getting away from it, has been poor and really disappointing, the overall picture is that Brighton are not far off where I would have expected them to be.
And what do you think the biggest challenge for Brighton was this season?
Well, there was a combination of circumstances, really. I think Chris tried to changed the style a bit, the formation he used around December time. His kind of go-to formation was a 4-4-1-1. He went to 4-3-3. The reasons behind that were really to try and get a bit more possession and create more chances. In certain games, that did happen, but they didn't take the chances. And also, it came a bit at the expense of their real strength, which is defensive resilience. But, you know, also, we shouldn't forget, there were two players in particular who were so instrumental last season, who he didn't have for a lot of the campaign. I talk about that 4-4-1-1. Pascal Gross in the number 10 role was a revelation in Brighton's first season. 7 goals, I think it was, 8 assists, £3 million from Ingolstadt in Germany. I think it was always going to be more difficult for Pascal in the second season, regardless, because suddenly people know about him. But the fact is, he had two fairly long-term injuries, quite early on ankle ligament damage, and then later in the season, a hamstring. Then you've got Jose Izquierdo, Colombian winger, who injured his knee in the World Cup. He, in the latter half of Brighton's first season, again, started to really shine. He scored 5 goals in their first season. He had the knee, came back, had another knee, so he's barely played, and towards the end was coming on in games off the bench, but it did feel like desperation. You could just tell he wasn't right. So in those two players, Chris Hughton lost 12 goals and 12 assists from a team that had scored 34 goals in their first season. So I don't think anyone should underestimate how big a blow losing those two players has been. And also, the fact of the matter is, the signings made last summer, some of the defensive stroke midfield signings, Bernardo, good young Brazilian at left back, looks promising. Yves Bissouma, young Malian midfielder, shows real signs of promise and naivety at the same time. But it's really in the forward areas where it matters most, where Brighton have struggled. You know, their record signing, Alireza Iheanacho, that hasn't come off so far at all. No goals, no assists. Florin Andoni, who they tracked through 2 to 3 windows, he's been injured a fair bit. That hasn't really come off so far. That is going to be the area, that they really are going to have to get right this summer.
And Andy, taking a look at that attack, Glenn Murray obviously had another great season. He's still defying the odds at his age and he's scoring in double figures at the moment. Do you see that Brighton will probably target a striker in the off-season as maybe their first bit of business? Obviously, you said Alireza Iheanacho hasn't slotted in exactly what would have been what Brighton fans would have been hoping for. But can you see them maybe looking to make a move for maybe someone that one of the strikers that went down, like an Alexander Mitrovic or someone from abroad?
Well, for me, they have to. They have to do something about that forward area. But, you know, in the Premier League, there are no guarantees. But you know, you're going to have to spend pretty big money to raise the quality for a front man. They were interested in Mitrovic when he was at Newcastle. But there was no way Newcastle were going to let him go to Brighton at that stage. You know, they've kind of been quite close together in terms of where they've been at, those two clubs. What happens from here with Mitrovic, who knows? I guess it partly depends on, you know, the way Fulham are approaching things after their relegation. But certainly they do need something more in that forward area. Glenn Murray has done fantastically. 12 goals last season. He's actually bettered it this season, got 13, with probably, well, not even probably, definitely less service. You know, he's often been a bit isolated. But the fact of the matter is, in the Premier League, Brighton should not be relying on a 35-year-old week in, week out to lead the line. You know, you really want Glenn, certainly in some games, you have him on the bench. What a great option with 20 minutes left, whether it be to try and get you a goal or help you avoid conceding a goal, you know, because he's quite plays an important role sometimes at set pieces as well. So definitely that forward area needs addressing this summer if Brighton are going to improve on what Chris Hughton has done in the two seasons that in the Premier League that he was in charge.
Yeah, I've got to agree with you on that one, Andy. It is quite hard to stay up, especially if you haven't got that forward depth. You know, we've seen it throughout the years of teams that just haven't had that striker to bang in the goals, and eventually it comes back to bite you, obviously, as well. Andy, I'm a big Wigan fan, and I saw it when they went down as well. They had the problem with not having a striker for that period of time who was consistent in front of goal, and it came back to bite them. And just looking back at your squad as well, Bruno Seltzer announced his retirement, a long-serving right-back of the club who's been a stalwart down there. Can you see Brighton potentially dipping into the transfer window as well to get a right-back in? I believe that Rhys James is one of the guys that's been targeted.
Yeah, they definitely will need to sign a right back. They signed Martin Montoya last summer, Bruno, fellow Spaniard, who has kind of kept him out of sight a lot of the time. The jury's a little bit out on Martin Montoya. He's done okay. You know, I think he's played more than half the games, but he's in a slightly different situation to what he was in Spain in terms of defending in a team that is, you know, a struggling team towards the wrong end of the table. But they will definitely have to get in another right back. I'm certainly aware of the fact that Rhys James is a player they like and are interested in. The issue really with Chelsea's players this coming season is going to be this transfer embargo. You know, they have this system of loaning lots of these young players out. And who knows, that they might need to keep hold of a few of them the way it stands at the moment.
And in terms of a new manager, who are Brighton targeting at the moment?
Well, they're targeting Graham Potter, who has had one season in the Championship at Swansea, took them to 10th. They appointed him after he had a really successful 7 years in Sweden with a side called Osterlund. Took them from the fourth tier to the top tier in Sweden and the Europa League, which was some effort really, which included in the Europa League, they actually beat Arsenal at the Emirates. He's recognised as a kind of bright, you know, he's coming up 44, young coach, a little bit unconventional, you know, not necessarily sort of a conventional methods. This feeds into Tony Bloom's kind of the way he's generally gone with managers in his time as chairman. Chris Hughton was kind of not the way he's gone usually. Gus Poyet, Oscar Garcia, Sammy Hippier. If you look back to those appointments, they would have been appointments at the time that not many people would have seen coming. And I think this is another one. You know, I'm sure on Monday morning when the news broke about Chris Hughton, I don't think the first name that would have popped into people's heads was...
But he it remains to be seen. It's a big call, there's no doubt about it. It's a huge call. It can go one of two ways. Graham Potter might well come in. The style of play might be more, he does have a passing style of play, so it might well be that it's something the supporters enjoy more and the Brighton's position in the table improves. Or they might find that a more expansive style, they haven't got the right players, finds them out in the Premier League, because you do get found out at that level, and it could go the other way, and that would be a disaster.
Well, Andy, thank you so much for joining us on Evenings on FNR to chat about it all. And we look forward to getting you back on the show sometime soon. That was Brighton and Hove Albion reporter Andy Naylor chatting to us there. We lost a little bit of the connection there in the end. But great to hear what he had to say. We know that the Seagulls do have a bit of work to do in this summer transfer window, and it will be crucial for their survival next season.
They have to, and they have to make sure they get those players in. As you did say, they need a striker. Glenn Murray's been fantastic for them. I'm a massive Glenn Murray fan, and Nick Hughes out there in the back, our producer, absolutely loves him as well. And Alireza Yohanbakhsh hasn't necessarily paid off in the way they'd be hoping for, who was a record signing. Florian Andone as well has necessarily lived up, so they're going to be having to look to get another striker in. I think they should be ambitious and go after Alexander Mitrovic, obviously had a great season for relegated Fulham, who would be a fantastic player to bring in. And if they do need a right back, I'm all on the Reece James bandwagon, obviously a great young player who spent last season on loan in the Championship and was great for Wigan. Right now on Chelsea's books at the moment, but it will be tough considering that transfer ban.
And it is also, do you think it comes back to the spending power of a club like Brighton?
It is, but it's also the pool of going to play for Brighton, because Brighton as well is a team that forever, for this period of time, are going to be that team that's just going to have to keep staying up. They're going to be always under the pump, and they're always going to be one of the favourites to go down. And unfortunately, next season, they'll be in that same bracket. They're going to have to try break that stigma and try and get big results. If they can get a few big players in via it being from outside investment or whatever it could be, or just doing some smart signings like Pascal Gross was for $3 million, who was able to come in and do what he did. That is exactly the sort of moves they need to be making. So hopefully Brighton just make those nice moves to get themselves up the table a little bit. Louise, we said tomorrow morning as well, Leeds versus Derby in that Championship final. Make sure that if you want to watch that game, 4:30 tomorrow on Bein Sports.
And while we are in England, well, actually the UK, but more so Manchester, I hear that Napoli's Koulibaly is actually United's number one transfer target.
Number one transfer target, but I don't see him going to Manchester United. I just believe at the moment the pool of staying playing Champions League at Napoli would be too much. I don't see, unless Manchester United are willing to fork out big money, why he would potentially be attracted to that move.
Well, that's it, because his contract doesn't expire until 2023.
No, I don't see him leaving Napoli. I think that he'll be there for the long run. Just a quick little tidbit here. Tomorrow morning is the Coppa Italia final as well. Atalanta up against Lazio. Big game for those two teams, especially Atalanta, a chance at winning some silverware. But it will be big for them, because at the same time they're battling against the top four of the champion of the Serie A and get Champions League qualification.
Hopefully, so they can get UCL qualification.
No, I hope that Milan get there instead. So that's
I'm going for Atalanta.
They can maybe sneak in there just ahead of maybe Inter, and Milan could take Inter's spot. That would be a little bit more ideal.
That's it. But Nick's fantasy.
No, but as we said, obviously 4:45 tomorrow, Atalanta Lazio. I think Atalanta are going to take it home, but it could come back to bite them because they play Juventus on the weekend. So a long game might just tire them out a little bit. And as we did say, Louise, as well, Antoine Griezmann as well, potentially on the way out.
Well, he is. It's been confirmed.
Well, nothing's confirmed in football. Some players say they're leaving and don't end up leaving at the end. So if he does leave, well, I guess we'll wait and see.
Nick, thank you for joining me here in the studio. We'll see you again at the same time tomorrow. Bye for now.
You're listening to Evenings on FNR, Football Nation Radio.